Episode 3, Just Enough Math. Welcome to the third episode of the Play Board Games Better podcast. In this episode, I'll present just enough math to make your gameplay better, but not enough to make your head hurt. If you already have enough math because you are smarty pants, you can just fast forward to my interview with the gamingest family I know, who just happened to be named Shay. Really, no relation. It couldn't be any less likely if it were fiction. How much math do you need? The more the merrier, but this is a hobby and math makes many people's heads hurt. The goal is to make reasonable assumptions about what might happen. If you think you are making a move likely to succeed, and the reality is that it is unlikely to work, you are suffering from a math deficiency. If you know the probability to 3 decimal places, you are working too hard. Can you really differentiate to that level in comparing outcomes? So I'll try to keep things simple and approximate. In a single play of a game is a 5%, that's a 1/20th difference, in probable outcome a big deal? Can you even visualize that difference? When I don't give actual calculations, I won't consider differences of less than 5% to be noticeable. That's not very professorial, but we are playing games here, not doing homework. The first thing to understand is that most of the random events in games are independent. No, really. If you roll a 6 5 times in a row, the next roll has a 1/6 chance of being another 6. It's actually counterintuitive, your brain doesn't like it. You tell yourself that it just can't happen again. But what happened already has no bearing on what happens next. Though after a while, I might try to find another die to roll. Randomness doesn't mean evenness of results, though. Quite the opposite, in fact. I've known plenty of people with good mathematical educations who still can't get past this point. It is, I think, the most common error-inducing thought. Accept it, repeat it, believe it. The second thing you have to understand involves the probability of getting what you want when you select from a pool. Usually it's a deck of cards, but it could be from a pile of tokens. Here, the hard part is understanding what you are drawing from. You could just assume the odds are determined by the pile of remaining cards. In fact, it could also be influenced by the cards other players are holding that you can't see. In determining the probability of getting what you need, you have to consider their hidden cards to be part of the deck you are considering, even if you can't have those cards. If you don't know what they are, you have to assume the cards you need could be in those cards as well. If there's a way to exclude that possibility, then the calculations are completely different. The simple stuff. Let's get a mental image of what is probable, and then you can think about risk tolerance. By that I mean, what do you consider acceptable odds when making a decision? In real life, I am pretty conservative, and not given to taking chances. When playing a game, I am less conservative, but I'm still not a big risk taker, but I am working on it. It's best to vary your risk tolerance to your situation. If you are behind in a game and don't have a solid strategy to catch up, you will have to take more risks in hope of doing better. I like to use percentages rather than fractions to compare probabilities for 2 reasons. 1, they are more directly comparable. Comparing a half to a third is harder than comparing 50% to 33%. 2, I have an easier time grasping the differences between percentages as opposed to fractions. Let's look at the common fractions as percentages. A half is 50%. A third is 33%, although we might round it to 35%. A sixth is 17%, so you might want to round that to 15%. 1/52nd, which is one card drawn out of a full deck of regular playing cards, is a tiny bit less than 2%. Often, for cards, decks are in the range of 50 to 60 cards, giving each individual card about a 2% chance of being next. But this changes quickly as cards are played and drawn. The simplest way of determining risk is by dividing the number of desirable choices from the pool or die roll by the total number of choices. For a single event, it can be simple. If you roll a 6-sided die and you need a 5 or 6 to succeed, there are two desirable choices out of six possible choices. You'll succeed in 2/6 of the possible outcomes. In our crude system, that's 35% of the time you are happy. If instead you are drawing from a set of six cards numbered 1 to 6, and 5 or 6 were good outcomes, the probability is the same. But now we come to the fork in the road. If you need a second number, re-rolling the die is completely different from choosing another card while holding on to your first card. In fact, these are the two broad classes of events found in games. 1. Sample with replacement, that's roll the die. 2. Sample without replacement, that's draw from the now altered deck of cards. Mostly die rolls. Sampling with replacement just means that the possible outcome for each die roll or card pull was not changed by previous actions. This is easy to understand for a die roll, and is a good way to visualize what independent means. There is an infinite supply of die rolls, and you don't change the pool by rolling a die. For cards or tokens, it would mean that you draw one and then mix it back in before drawing again. That's not how most games work. They usually have a small pool of cards or tokens that you choose from. In the real world, though, you can draw a sample like one person, and that doesn't significantly change the remaining pool. In a game, it would be like drawing a few cards from a deck of several hundred cards. Each card removed has only a tiny effect on the composition of the remaining deck. The probabilities with replacement are fairly easy to calculate. For one event, as explained above, it's the number of wanted events divided by the number of possible events. If you have to consider several events together, you can multiply the probabilities of each event together to get the probability of a total desired outcome. Here are some examples for six-sided die. The probability of any single number is 1, the number desired, over 6, the number of possibilities. The probability of snake eyes is the probability of a 1 times the probability of another 1, which is 1/6 times 1/6, which is a 36, about 3%. Probability of doubles, 1 or certainty, because you're going to get a number, times the probability of that number on the second die is 1 times 1/6, about 17%. It's all pretty straightforward, and there are other legitimate ways to calculate or demonstrate the probabilities. Since all math is just glorified counting, you can draw a picture of all possible outcomes and count the spaces, but this gets very tricky with more than 2 dice. Clumping. Before we go on to the trickier world of sampling without replacement, I want to cover something else non-intuitive. Clumping. The fact is that randomness is not the same as uniformity. In fact, it is quite the opposite. You shouldn't expect groups of results to have an even distribution. Too much uniformity should make you suspicious. Probably already does if you are a gamer. But perhaps you haven't thought it through to the end. I am sure you have noticed while playing games that certain results happen repeatedly. In a game of Settlers of Catan, my gaming buddy Joel kept rolling 4 on 2 dice. A lot. He noticed it because it was the one roll that benefited the other players, but not him. In disgust, he finally pulled out his iPad Touch and used a die rolling program to roll, of course, another 4. It's actually not surprising. If we use our simple skills developed above, we can ask, how likely are we to roll 5 dice without repeating the number? We can multiply together the probabilities of succeeding on each die roll. On the first roll, a 1, we always get one number. Second roll, 5/6, only one number matches. Third roll, 4/6, two of the numbers match the previous rolls. Fourth roll, 3/6, you can see where this is going. And on the fifth roll, 2/6. If you do the math, it's 5 times 4 times 3 times 2 over 6 times 6 times 6 times 6. And you can reduce that by scratching out things to get 5 over 6 times 3 times 3, or 5/54. A little less than 10%. So even a modest amount of evenness is unexpected. Sadly, what clump will occur is not predictable. You can just expect clumping and not rely on results evening out. Cards and tokens. Thinking about selecting cards and tokens is different because the pile of available items you choose from changes with each choice. and the odds change with both the change in size and depending on the types of items left. The math is similar but different. The easy way to think about it is to count the possible arrangements after each choice. But from multiple draws, the order you draw them is usually not important, so different orders result in the same hand. There are 46 plantation tiles at the start of a four-player game of Puerto Rico, after removing two indigo and two corn for the players. If we want to know the probability of getting all five types of plantations showing at once, we first need the number of possible different draws from the whole pile. There are 46 different first draws and 45 different second draws for 46 times 45, or 2,070 draws of two tiles. Of course, they each only look like the 15 different pairs of plantation types. We repeat this kind of calculation until we get five tiles for 46 times 45 times 44 times 43 times 42 for 164.5 million combinations. Of course, it is a lot fewer effectively different draws because there are only five kinds of tiles, and we don't care about order. Each identical set of tiles can be arranged 120 ways. That's 5 times 4 times 3 times 2 times 1. So we can divide by that to take out order. That leaves 1,370,754 unique sets. So how many of those sets contain one of each type of plantation? The 8 corn compare with the 10 indigo for 80 sets. These can match against the 11 sugar for 880. With the 9 tobacco and 8 coffee, there are 63,360 sets of 5 different plantations. Divide that by the total number of sets, and you only get a 4.6% chance of seeing all 5 plantation types at once. Now, I sort of made a trick above. I took out the ordering stuff to get the 1.3 million, and I put together the possible combinations without reordering them, so I'd already taken care of the ordering in that. I hope that's not too confusing. Two lessons are taught here. One, you won't be able to do complex estimates about drawing from decks in your head. Two, complex combinations become unlikely pretty quickly, even if they seem typical. Figuring the odds past a draw of two gets tough without a calculator or computer in front of you. The point of all this is that in playing a game, you'll be making decisions in uncertainty. Your responsibility is to have a good idea of the risk involved, and then to decide if that risk is acceptable. So the second part is, what is an acceptable risk? Too often, you'll have to make decisions like that in real life, and I won't presume to advise you there. In games, the risk that is acceptable is determined by both your personal risk tolerance and by your current position in the game. If you're behind, and that wasn't part of your strategy, then you should be willing to take a bigger risk for a bigger reward, in order to catch up with the leader. If you are out in front, there is no reason to make risky moves as opposed to just working on expanding your lead steadily. If you have no idea of how risky a move is, you might jeopardize your lead for no significant gain. So we need a cost-benefit analysis of the move. Simplistically, this is just the value of a move multiplied by its probability. In other words, you calculate an average outcome. That is unlikely to reflect the actual value of the move because of some other considerations. 1. The actual outcome is often either zero or some value much larger than the average. 2. Will a good outcome give you a shot at winning? If it doesn't, then it really doesn't matter what the average is. 3. What will the outcome deny or give to the other players? When you've considered these points, along with an estimate of the probabilities, you are ready to make your move and live with the outcome, knowing you gave it your best shot. I'll include more boring math in the future, but it will be in smaller doses. For this episode's interview, I talked with the Shays. They are a complete family of gamers. I first met them at TotalCon in 2007, and I've gamed with them there and at WBC since then. They're all competitive gamers. I caught up with them at EuroQuest in November of 2010 and interrupted their game of Radis.
Hi, I'm here with the other Shays, not relatives this time, unlike my interview with Rich. Get Mike and Linda and Lexi, but we don't have their son Jordan. Now, the Shays are the most competitive gaming family that I know. Yes, okay, but they get four sharks. I only have a shark and a minnow. How did you guys become a gaming family?
It started for us in college. We were playing, you play Illuminati and the traditional American games, and then someone introduced us to Settlers, and I believe that's all she wrote.
Oh, but we've always played games throughout our lives. I mean, board game isn't anything new. It's just the types of board games that changed over the years.
Yeah, we don't have the romantic story of board games brought you together, and now?
No, nope. Computers did.
Oh, computers did. Okay, like, because I actually know one magic couple.
Oh, we did magic when Lexi was born.
While waiting for the delivery. So, but Lexi, how old were you before did they force you to play games or sit off in a corner or play games with mom and dad?
I started with cribbage when I was really young. My dad taught me. And just year by year, I would watch them and eventually join in on games. I don't know how long ago it was that.
You can't remember how early it was? Now, when did you all get competitive? Like move from just playing games to going to conventions with tournaments?
Tournament-wise, I mean, Michael and I started going to Unity Games on our own. We had read about it in the Boston newspaper. And Lexi and Jordan would just stay with my parents.
That was nice.
And, well, we went to that, but then all of a sudden, you know, she started playing these things at home, and they were like, well, can we go and play? And we were like, at first, we brought them in for the last couple hours. Okay, you can try it. And then they made friends there. They made friends with the adults there, and it just kind of blossomed from there. So I would say Unity Games brought them in, and then from Unity Games, we heard about other local cons
now,
and such.
I had mentioned Unity because there's not a lot on tournaments at Unity.
No, it's all open gaming, except for some demo events, and she plays Wizard and things like that, and they have a Wizard tournament, so it kind of starts small scale there.
And then when did you decide that you wanted to graduate to Sharkdom, Lexi? Because when I met you, you were already all teeth for gaming. You were dangerous to play with, and you can't see Lexi. She doesn't look imposing. Not like Rob Kircher, where you might be physically concerned, but nonetheless, Lexi will give you a big battle. Not that Mike and Linda aren't very good players, they are. I think I just run up against Lexi and been defeated more times than against her parents.
Well, Michael and I went to WBC for the kids one and to try it out. And, you know, he always felt confident about his Puerto Rico game. He actually taught it to Lexi.
And so is that one of the biggest mistakes of your life?
Now I can't win.
And now it's like she picks things up so quickly. And it's like, and then she formulates her own strategy. She works so well with whatever she has, and now he starts stealing her strategies.
Well, that's what this podcast is all about. You know, find the best strategies and try to learn how to use them. Now, Jordan's not here to defend himself. Is he as excited about gaming as the rest of you? He's that age where you can't tell what he's excited about. He hides that. He hides it well, but he's playing and he's here.
He's coming to his own more this past year. And
oh, yeah.
He was like, he's always been a more of a video game person, and he likes doing the games with us as a family, but he's kind of like been under the radar for a long time, and now he has a lot more confidence, and he knows he can go into any situation with adults and still play. I mean, up until last year, he was going into the juniors room with the WBC, and now it's like, I don't want to be in the juniors room, I want to
He wants to be in the Big Shark game.
He did. I think it's when the kids hit that 13, 14 year old age, that's when they become able to stand on their own, assuming they've been playing for a couple years.
Why is competitive gaming important to you all? Whole family's competitive, not just casual. What do you like about competitive gaming?
We are competitive, I will give you that. But we like gaming for gaming. And it was like, we never pushed them to be competitive. It was one of those things, it's come out through the way that we play and that it brings out the best in everybody.
The other thing is, when you play with the best, you learn more.
Yeah.
So if you're always beating the people you play with, you don't learn anything. You learn by losing. And that's, I think, the other thing, is you want to play with people who can beat you.
So what makes one game more interesting in competition than another? I know I have games that are my favorites in tournaments, and then there are games I like a lot, but I would not play in a tournament. Stone Age comes to mind right now.
Oh, look, you hate to play a game where it all depends on the roll of a dice, because I always roll ones, which... In Stone Age, rolling one dice for food, and I roll a one.
I roll fives and sixes a lot with the Christmas card.
Yes.
What about you, Lexi? What makes a game interesting or not interesting? How do you decide which tournaments you're going to be in?
It was just over the years, the games that I just continued to play over and over. I like most games. Some games I like having doing strategy more, and not always luck, and trying to figure out how to make the best of the situation. But I still like some other games, like Settlers, when it's all on the roll of the dice. I just like having fun with it.
Like, what game do you think you play best, and why?
Probably Puerto Rico, just because I just try to make the best of the situation I'm in, and I try to adapt to it as best as I can. And, like, it would depend on what the other people do, interacting with them, and it all depends on how that works.
Linda, what do you think you play best?
I'm more of the lighter games. I mean, I like the strategic games, but, I like games, you know, like that you could see in the wild card tournament. Like I like the Settlers. I like the Alhambra. I like the ones that I can sit down and not have it be like this massive brain burner. There's still some strategy involved, but there's a lot of interaction, talking with others. That's what makes it fun for me. Yeah, that's fun.
Mike?
For me, it's the card-driven war games. Memoir 44, Battle Lore, Command and Colors.
Those are your best games.
Those are the ones that I enjoy playing the most, that also, unfortunately, take 12 hours if you're going to do a tournament, and you have single
the
eliminations.
The tournaments for those are pretty brutal.
Then the Santa Fe Rails that you treat like a war game.
Yeah, and Santa Fe Rails. Santa Fe Rails is one which, yes, it
so
is a war game.
You like games that have some screwage, as we say.
I like games where...
Or you're just attacking the other guy.
Or that you have control, that you can control and permit someone else to do anything. For instance, in Magic, I play blue.
Well, and so, Lexi, I think with her, for things that she likes, like the Power Grid, the Puerto Rico, there's a lot of thinking involved, too. For her, the math, it's like it comes in and she can see the right combinations of things.
Are there games that you like to play, but that you wouldn't play in a competitive setting? It wouldn't be your first choice anyway. So that's why it's the Shark family. They like games that you can play competitively.
No, I mean, the thing is, it's like, we'll play some games no matter what the situation is. I mean, it's like, it doesn't have to be a tournament and we'll still play it.
So what are your favorites like that? Your absolute favorite game to play, as opposed to your favorite to get a plaque in?
Well, what are you...
I don't think there's much of a difference. I like playing most games that I compete in. I just like playing the games.
I mean, we play things casually at home, and sometimes they don't offer the tournaments, though, you know, things that we like, but we'll still play.
But you don't have favorites. You guys just have lots of games. Huh?
Yeah. We do, and we play them, you know, we cycle through, you know, just about everything.
I think the one that we like to play that we don't play in tournaments, it's not very offered, is would be probably Cities and Nights.
Cities and Nights,
because
and Crocodile,
that one
too.
Is a lot of conflict that wouldn't work well in a tournament.
I think you're right.
And also the dexterity games that you yeah. Yeah. That kind of thing. We like that.
So when you guys get a new game and you're figuring out learn it, do you have like a standard approach? Do you like study together? Or
they hand the rules to me and I read them. And then after I read them, I try to explain it, and we fumble through and realize I forgot to explain a rule.
Yes.
Do the rest of you then read the rules and check up on him, or you just take Dad's word for it?
Unfortunately, I'll be like, are you sure? And I have to go back. Oh, yes. See, you missed that again, you know. But yeah, see, I'm one of those. I'm a visual learner, and I like Tom Vassell reviews. I like the other reviews that they do online. And so I get to see an overview of it before we actually sit down and play it together.
Now, this is a sort of critical question, but you guys play against a lot of different people.
Yeah.
Okay? For the people that you play against a lot, watching them play, what do you think would be the most important skill or piece of information they should improve to improve their playing? For me, for example, I think a lot of people didn't read the rules. A lot of people actually don't know the rules in detail and get themselves into trouble because they either forget or don't have a framework in their head.
The thing of it is, we're still coming here. I mean, even though it's a tournament setting, you still feel like it's going to be a casual atmosphere. And you realize that some people are very serious about it. I mean, we come in, and yes, we have that level of competitiveness, but we're not, like, driven to that point of we're coming to still have fun. And, yeah, we might forget something even though we kind of know the rules, but it's... I go to things, and I want to learn the games. I like to go to games, the demos.
So you'd rather improve the behavior of the other players and make it at the same level of casualness as you feel, but you don't want to criticize your play? Come on, Lexi.
So, I mean, that's one of the things that you shouldn't assume what your opponent is going to play. And, for example, Puerto Rico. The person who says, I'm going to do this, and then you're going to do that, and you should do that.
That's a guess. Some people think it's a fact.
And what people should do is realize that some people play suboptimal.
Or being critical of why did you do that?
More than that, just play your game and don't try to play everyone else's game. Because right. Someone else may be playing an entirely different game.
You've taken different approaches to Puerto Rico, and they're caught off guard because there's a standard way that, you know, the different rounds are supposed to be played.
One last question. Is there one thing you change about the way tournaments are organized or run that you've been in? Anything about the way that, you know, they decide things that sort of bugs you a little bit and you'd like to see done differently? You can always say no in case Don listens.
Not particularly. Like, sometimes I have conflicts with different games. And it overlaps. But usually the tournaments are run pretty well, and I don't really have any changes.
I know people try, and they're all volunteers. You know, in my mind, I have to compare the way tournaments are run a little bit to the way Magic tournaments are run. It's a different scale, but it's done totally differently. There's some money. People get paid for running the Magic tournaments. This is all volunteers, and they do the best they can.
One of the things would be if you're going to have a special rule, whether the special rule is who advances, what the elimination round is, or the we're playing with this variant, that it should be in the schedule, not only online. Some tournaments say, well, that was online. Not everyone is online. Not everyone has a smartphone.
Anyways, yes, especially the smartphone, yeah. Not everybody can look it up while they're playing.
So if you have a program, the pertinent information should be in the program.
True. Put in an extra page or two. Anything else you want to add?
I think, you know, I commend anybody that EuroQuest, WBC, to Unity Games, when they organize these things, there's so much work and effort that goes into it that for us to sit and be
I don't think anybody thinks we're being critical. It's just things that we like better, things that should be thought about.
I wouldn't want to take over and do that job right now. I look forward to them handling it. I come in and we come to play. That's kind of nice.
And yes, that is true. That if you're going to be critical of someone, be prepared to step into their shoes.
Absolutely correct. That's my first rule of criticism. The person that washes the dishes get to criticize the dishwasher. All right. Well, thanks a lot, folks.
Thank you.
I hope you have a safe trip home, and I'll see you all again at TotalCon, if not earlier, right?
That's right. That's
absolutely.
Right.
Thanks.
That wraps up episode 3. Next time, we start on actual gameplay. The first game we will look at will be Puerto Rico. It's one of the most highly rated games on Board Game Geek, and to my mind, one of the most challenging tournament games played. So watch for the next episode. You can contact me on the site playboardgamesbetter.com or by sending email to playboardgamesbetter@gmail.com. If you have a game you'd like explored on this podcast, or would like to sponsor a podcast, please get in touch. Thanks for listening.